because there is actually, if you think about it, privilege in who gets to not give a fuck. A lot of people give a lot of fucks. We care hard and we try hard. And then I go back to you many years ago defending Anne Hathaway against James Franco and trying too hard at the Oscars, and you always saying, I would rather someone try so hard than having someone not try at all.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Lainey. I'm the founder and editor of LaineyGossip.com. I'm a talk show host in Canada and also an entertainment reporter. This week, I became, I think, the face of Basic Bitch Hot Dogs.
I'm Duana Taha. I am a television screenwriter and producer and the proud parent of a child who tried to school you in Marvel movie trivia and did a decent job.
He really did.
This week on the show, it is all about how you use what you have. First, we are talking about Adele's secret weapon. That is that razor sharp sense of humor and how she's going to use it if and when the critics come calling about that picture and that weight loss conversation in the face of what we hope is a new album release. Someday?
Speaking of secret weapons, Michelle Obama becoming the documentary and how it became. We get into the work behind it. We get into the work that some people might not be willing to see and what that says about their expectations versus what they expect of her.
And finally, what happens when suddenly somebody becomes super famous, but for reasons they would rather not? We are talking about New York Times food writer Alison Roman and what happened over the weekend to suddenly make her a name everybody knows.
This is Show Your Work. Was the last concert we went to Adele?
Together?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Or was it Beyonce? It was around. It was the same year for sure.
Yeah, it was a good year, but Beyonce was in the summer, and Adele was like October,
right?
Because I remember the dress that she wore. It was a full, like, long sleeve. It was appropriate for October.
So the reason I'm saying this is because that tour was the tour where she was like, I might not be touring again for a long, long time. And a long, long time for Adele is not like a long, long time for other artists, you know, 2 years. A long, long time for Adele. I mean, she was talking about a decade.
Yeah, she meant it. I mean, that was for the album 25. She was at the time, I want to say 28, 29, right?
Like, yeah.
That, or by the time it released, she was 28, 29. Yeah, she was serious about it. And she was real, how do you put it? Like, descriptive of her life, right? My favorite part. Remember she made a joke about people who don't pull out?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that, like, lives are shaped by the fact that people don't pull out?
Yep.
And then, yeah, lots of that. So I guess in that version of things, she thought she wouldn't have stuff to write about. And then that favorite expression of mine, man plans, God laughs, right?
Yep. And since then, not to say that she's, I mean, when she said, I'm going away for a while, she tried to mean it in that we don't get a lot of Adele. There is a unicorn sighting here and there, but she's not super active on social media. The latest post that she posted that was the talk of all last week was her first post of 2020. She lives in LA, and you'd think that people who live in LA are spotted here and there, but generally she keeps to herself. We don't really know what her movements are. And we keep hearing that there is an album on the way. Every year there's an album on the way, but we keep hearing that it was supposed to be released, or it could still be released, this fall.
Well, that's fast. You're catching me just off of reading Alicia Keys' autobiography, which is really like a story of the artist's journey or whatever. But part of what she talks about is how long it can take to write an authentic album, or how quick it can go when you're really feeling it or whatnot. Obviously, Adele is on nobody's schedule. So I guess the question is, if it comes out this fall, if that post that everybody had an opinion on was posted in, what was that, early May, does she have time to write a song about people's reactions and mocking them? Like, is there, because you know, this is what I love about Adele, right? She knew that people were going to react to her look and to the new Adele, whatever the fuck. She knew this was going to stir up talk about the album, right? So can she actually bang out a song about stupid opinions in the media or whatever and manage to get it on the album?
And is that a way for her not to have to answer the inevitable questions when she's promoting the album? If she does promote the album, if there even is an album, like...
So basically we're in Inception here is what you're saying. But this is the place where I have the most faith in Adele. This is where I'm not worried at all. She will, you know, she'll open any interview with a crack about, so how carefully crafted was your question about my weight? And like, just pull the rug out from under them in the first 20 seconds. And as each reporter is sitting there gobsmacked, like just effortlessly set the tone, right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned memoirs and you mentioned having this conversation. And a few weeks ago, we talked about Jessica Simpson's memoir, Open Book. And
still so good.
Still so good. And yes, she addresses in the book what it was like having your body talked about from not just the media, but from your ex-lovers or your current lovers at the time.
Right. Yeah. That she was, she and her sex life and her body were just a regular topic of conversation.
That's right. So actually it's even more than that. As you mentioned, her body wasn't just talked about by the media and by John Mayer. From the time that she was an adolescent, it was being talked about in church.
Yeah, among the adults in her life. Her body was like a character, for sure.
Yeah. And so it is a through line through Open Book, Jessica Simpson's book, where she talks about struggling with her weight and her own body image and having to talk about it or not talking about it and where she is at it with it now. And the ongoing, whatever, 25-year conversation about her body that she has had to hear and participate in. And I feel like for Adele, we're going to see, or, I mean, is it more of the same? How will she handle it? That is the interesting work part of it to us, is like sidestepping a conversation, which I already addressed on the site, a conversation about what that conversation was about. Now it's how you move on from that conversation when it's time to move on.
Right. But I think she's so smart. I think the difference is that if you are an adolescent, you are surprised at the amount of focus on your body, or you didn't know you had a body or whatever. Adele knows. Of course she knows. She beats everybody to the punch. She beats everybody to every reference. The quotes that have been about her weight or body or health up to this point have been filled with like, God, you know, I don't give a fuck. I'm doing this because I have to. And so I feel like that's, I think, where I'm coming from, where I feel like she's either going to be able to turn the conversation to her advantage in the first 20 seconds, or she'll have that slightly shruggy thing that she does of like, are you still talking about that? Aren't you bored? And like, we'll go on to the album and why she's decided to name it after, I don't know, new like changes happening after 30. Cause I don't think she's going to keep calling them 33 and 37. And maybe she will. I don't know.
I agree. I think that you're right. Adele has always been like clever and quippy about it, but also really prescient. There was a quote back in 2015. She gave an interview and she talked about what she thought her appeal was. And she directly addressed the fact that she thought that a lot of people could relate to her. And she questioned, she was like, sometimes I wonder if I would have been this successful if I didn't look the way I do. That's a really interesting comment to make from Adele's position. And so I wonder now, given how prescient she was 5 years ago in almost predicting this kind of reaction, whether or not she'll have something even more insightful now that it's shifted and all this is happening right now.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think what Adele is not saying in that earlier comment about if I don't look the way I do is because I have the voice of a god and nobody can relate to having the voice of a god. Maybe Beyonce, maybe. So she was sort of speaking to her own relatability, right? But the truth is that Adele, the person, and the reason you and I remember that concert that we went to so well and specific quips is so relatable anyway that I don't think she's going to, she may address it, but I don't actually think she's going to struggle with like not being as familiar to people or not being as relatable because every time she opens her mouth, she's just your funny ass friend, like the best person at the party on the couch on the like group text. So I don't think that if that goes somewhere, then we're in trouble. But yeah. I don't actually worry that people are going to feel like, oh, who are you now? Because she's still very much her. Although I wonder how many references to cigarettes are slowly being like ebbed out of her repertoire.
I can't wait for that album. If there even is an album. Like,
can we just be clear about this?
Like, she has not said anything. The label hasn't said anything. So there is no indication that there is anything.
Okay. So really, we're just saying that we think there's an album someday.
The same conversation about an album was happening at exactly this time last year in 2019. Oh, it's going to be out in the fall, blah, blah, blah. Didn't happen.
Yeah, I guess what's happened in the meantime, though, is, you know, she's posted the post. She's appeared on the thing. So we're meant to understand that she's, if not back, she's waving at us from over there. Right. She's like, hi, I'm still here.
Wouldn't that be something if this was like step one in a larger plan? Like, I can't wait then also, in addition to the album, to put it all together and start charting these steps and what they were.
I also can't wait, especially because, yeah, she moved to LA without anybody really knowing. So there, it could appear tomorrow and she'd just be like, what? I wasn't busy. You got the time to listen. Look, I'll work on my Adele voice before the album drops. All right.
So this Alison Roman situation, we recorded one version of our take on the story, and it has changed so much that we are now back and essentially having to not update the situation, but do a whole new section, really, of the podcast, because otherwise what we did a few days ago was already outdated.
Which it wasn't insubstantial, what we did a few days ago.
Nope.
But I'm going to quote you a few minutes ago. Direct quote, these two drama queens had a lot more to say.
That's right. So a quick recap. Alison Roman is a New York Times food writer. She has a column out every couple of weeks or so, very popular in certain food circles. Her recipe for the stew was one of the big food hits of 2019. She has two books.
Yeah.
One of them is called Nothing Fancy. I do not remember the name of the second book. Do you?
I don't. But Nothing Fancy is the one to know because that's also kind of her brand, right? That's her whole MO is just throwing stuff together, being super easy peasy. She's a cool girl.
She's a cool girl. Although she would say that she's never been the cool girl her entire life. Anyway, whatever. She has a certain fan base in a certain circle of a certain, I would say like a writer, New York elite, but doesn't claim to be elite, but is now elite media circle. Yeah?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to look at this without what we know now, but yeah, she certainly has the support of writer elites in mm-hmm. similar circles. She knows some big names in that place, and it's a distinctly separate circle from, say, Chrissy Teigen.
Right. So Alison Roman is interviewed by The New Consumer, and in this interview, she pops off on Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo, basically calling them sellouts. When this goes viral on Twitter, Chrissy Teigen responds and says she's hurt because she's a fan of Alison Roman. And then it turns out that she was about to executive produce a show featuring Alison Roman. And then Alison Roman sort of doubled down, but then apologized on Twitter. Then people came for Chrissy Teigen. Then Chrissy Teigen quit Twitter. And then Alison Roman has issued a lengthy apology through iOS notes. And Chrissy Teigen has responded to the apology. And hopefully as of Tuesday, May the 12th at 6:45 p.m., that is where we're at now. Yes?
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
I hope.
Lots of bad work on so many levels here, right? Not showing. How about these example of not showing your work?
I mean, I feel like because this has been such a public back and forth, I feel like we almost need to take a Judge Judy kind of approach, right? Just cutting through the offenses one by one. First off, Alison Roman runs her mouth. She criticizes Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo for selling out, as you say, based on products they endorse. She gets criticism for not criticizing other people with products in their name who are older, whiter, more established. You know, you're everybody from Bobby Flay to Martha Stewart to Gwyneth Paltrow to you name it. Those are not the mm-hmm. people who crossed her lips, right?
Correct.
There's also accusations of racism, not just because both women are Asian, but because of some really unfortunate at best, and that's being generous, language used to describe Marie Kondo's attitude towards selling the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first count. Next. Mm-hmm.
Well, on top of that, then, Alison Roman and Roxana Haddadi wrote a great piece for Pajiba about the stew and Alison Roman's appropriation, food appropriation, and the way that food culture has borrowed, some might say stolen, from ethnic foods, from foods from around the world, and made them, or at least repurposed them and made them sound easy, i.e. palatable to white palates, that people have brought up after this whole situation in relation to the stew, which is Alison Roman's most famous and popular recipe. Yeah?
Yeah. People said, wow, this is just like a curry I make, or this seems like a West Indian or Indian curry or whatever. Alison Roman responded at that time, I've never made a curry in my life. And it's like, oh, right. Okay, right.
All the ingredients were the same.
Yeah. If it's cumin and chickpeas and coconut milk, but you call it a stew and not a curry, you get the idea. So the woman is defensive and unwilling to give anybody any credit. Mm-hmm. To be clear, she's far from the only chef or recipe writer to have done this, right? But this is why this is coming up now, because those were sort of the initial sins.
And then when all of this was brought up, there was a little bit of a digging in of the heels and a joke, like, what was it, baby's first internet scandal or something like that?
I wish I had somebody to hold my hand through baby's first internet pylon or something.
Right. And then on the other side, there's Chrissy Teigen. So Chrissy responds to this saying that she's legitimately hurt, that she only tries to, she's only been trying to sort of carve out her own niche, that she is not a content factory, that she cares about everything that she does. And then what happens is that people start digging through Chrissy's old tweets, which, not a good look, some of the things that she tweeted in the past.
Right. But to be, to pause, and, you know, I think we're clear that, as you say, nobody has shown good work here, with one exception that we'll get to later. But I would say Chrissy was as vulnerable as Alison Roman in The New Consumer had been callous or you know, casually ridiculing, right? She was tender about this.
Yes.
And as you said, threw in, I was about to executive produce her show, but oh well. But yeah, it was all about, I'm hurt, I'm injured, etc.
That's right. To which some people responded, oh, you're just playing the victim. That is not my take, but that was some people's take. And then the old tweets came up. And then that is when Chrissy was like, okay, peace out. I can't handle this anymore. I'm done. And she quit Twitter for all of 24 hours.
Right. And to be clear, the tweets that they were criticizing, again, it was, what right do you have to talk or to be hurt? You're rich and beautiful. Oh, and by the way, you wrote this in 2009 or 2010. Does it make it okay, the things that she wrote? It doesn't.
No.
But the sins were certainly arguably further in the past. And as you and I say pretty much weekly, we're very grateful that not all of our sins are available for cataloging and combing through.
That's right. And I know to be trying to be as completely factual as we can, because I know some people will point it out, some of the tweets were from as recent as 2013 or 2014 or 2015. Anyway, the point is they were tweets that dated back a certain time. And in the interest of, like, making sure all our bases are covered so that we don't get fucking hauled out for not being thorough about this, some were transphobic, some were unkind towards babies. There's been accusations about condoning violence. All of this was, again, everybody pulling out receipts for everybody else. And where are we now, Duana?
Well, nobody is ever going to make a joke or say anything casually ever again, is where we are now. But Alison Roman released an apology, as you said, that is, it's long. It's two iOS screens long. It is very well written. Like, it is a fairly complete and it's a good apology in the sense that there is no, now, you know, 3 or 4 days after the fact, there is no, I'm sorry if you were offended. There's no, that's not what I meant, and my words were taken out of context.
Yeah.
It is straightforwardly, I did this and it was wrong. I punched down. It's wrong that the two women who came to my mind were, you know, Asian minority women, and I got to investigate that more. It was well done. Let us now pause. I have a question for you. There are people who suggest that she hired a crisis PR firm to help her to draft this, et cetera. Discuss.
Sure. Fine.
Fine. Yes, maybe. And also fine. Good. Like, good move.
Yeah. Yeah. Hire an expert. Whoever you hired is good at their job. So if the purpose of our podcast, Show Your Work, is to discuss work, then if there was someone hired here, I would like to commend that person or that firm for knowing what the job is and delivering on the job here. Well done.
100%. If that person is just your friend who is your calm, sober second thought, I think you and I have written many an email for one another and many, like drafted many a text for one another.
Yeah.
That's fine too. That person also deserves a bottle of wine and a sincere thank you. It's well done. I'm not forgiving her for anything. I'm not absolving anything. But as apologies go, especially since in the intervening days, we've seen other fucking celebrities ruin everything in their paths. This is as complete an apology as you would want in this situation.
As you said, this is not an absolution. However, what we do here is talk about execution of work. And after a series of badly executed work moves, this was whoever we credit it with, the publicist, the PR firm, the crisis management company, whatever. This is very good. This is very good. And here's why. In our first attempt at covering this story, much of my focus was on the fact that Alison Roman in this interview with the New Consumer was grandstanding. And I defined grandstanding as bigging yourself up and sometimes being resentful about other people's successes. Haven't we all been there? Looking at people who are adjacent to us in a certain industry. I don't understand why she's or he is getting all this attention. I could do that. I could do it better. I have already been doing this. Why are they getting all those deals? And what Alison Roman was doing in this interview was a certain type of grandstanding. Like, yeah, I could do that, but I'm choosing not to. And she acknowledges that in the second sentence of this apology, iOS apology. The second sentence reads, I use their names disparagingly to try and distinguish myself, which I have absolutely no excuse for. Or sorry, I think the exact words were, which I absolutely do not have an excuse for. That is an acknowledgement of a self, like that is an acknowledgement that she was grandstanding, that she was one of those people, as perhaps we've all been there, to be resentful and bitter that other people are successful for doing the same thing that you think that you could do better. Let me be the first person to put my hand up and say, I've been there. I have also grandstanded in my circle of friends. I have also thought in my alone moments, why is that person getting all the opportunities that I think I deserve and I'm not? I think that is very human. But to put it on the table on a public, in a public space like that, whoever we're crediting for this, I appreciated it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for what it's worth, my uncharitable thoughts, my I could do that ifs, they often come while I'm getting dressed. Make of that what you will. But yeah, lest we have skipped over one more element of bad work, I think Alison Roman assumed either that the interview she was doing with the New Consumer was, you know, a friend and therefore it was sort of like-minded people and they would feel the same way, or that the readership wasn't so big that she would have to answer for these phrases. And let us say now and clearly, you have to answer for anything you say in public at any time. That includes texts and tweets from 10 years ago. If somebody brings them up, you have to be prepared to stand behind them or suffer the consequences. Fair?
Fair.
Okay.
Now, beyond the suggestion, accusation, whatever, that this was written by somebody else or this was a hired hand helping, which we've already put aside and said, fine, when you're in a crisis, hire an expert.
For my own part, I bear no ill will if that's the case. Like, circle the wagons when you're in trouble.
Yeah. The other criticism about this iOS apology has been, hey, you're kind of just repeating like what others have said before and saying the right things, but are you following through with the actions?
That is
an interesting place to go.
Okay, go on. Yes.
I think that is an interesting place to go because Yeah, I don't think you can win. You're going to lose every time here. You're going to do the right, in quotes, kind of apology, but then you're still going to get people saying, prove it. And I don't think you can approve. You can prove it in one day.
Yeah, that's it. You can't prove it in 72 hours. I saw people that I respect, you know, calling for her to contribute to a charity that Chrissy and or Marie support to put her money where her mouth is. But that's literally throwing money at the problem. It doesn't re-educate. It doesn't actually change your mindset. And in fact, it can be a Band-Aid, right? To be like, look, I made a donation. I'm done.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. There's no good way to get out of it.
There's no winning.
No.
You know, but I mean, listen, when you are the architect of your own issue, then I don't know where the win comes from anyway. That said, I don't know how you win here except to be like, I suck. Please beat me up. Like, I don't know what would be enough for certain people. Not, again, to absolve anybody here, especially not Alice and Roman, but I don't know that, like, you know, just because other people have apologized in this way and she captured the same essence of those apologies and that language, I don't know that we should knock her for that either. There are places to knock her and we'll get there. But I think that we need to be judicious about where to really criticize the work. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I think that maybe one of the reasons that people are going to litigate the iOS apology, which I want you to trademark because I think it's a really funny term.
I think I might have stolen that from somebody. So, and I can't remember who right now. So I don't want people to come for me either. So please do not attribute that to me.
Fine. Whoever created that term, I love them. But one of the reasons that I think people are litigating it so closely is A, it looks pretty airtight. There doesn't look to be a particular error, a phrase that she's left out. She talks about how women of color are not responsible for educating her. She talks mm-hmm. about how, you know, she has appropriated without actually attributing in the past. She talks about how she, you know, she was scornful of ambition. That's my wording, not hers. But there is that acknowledgement there. What she doesn't say and what nobody else has said is, and I've lost my column at the New York Times, right? There's nothing that indicates that there has been a professional and permanent blowback. And these days, it seems as though that's what counts as appropriate contrition to people, right? It's not just, you know, to borrow terms from like the prison industrial complex, it's not just rehabilitation and correction, it's punishment. It's punitive, or that's the hope. And so I think that may be one of the reasons that people are digging so deep in this is there don't appear to have been permanent consequences. Unless there's been some breaking news in the last hour that I don't know about.
No. Yeah. And that is not to say that you and I are advocating for a permanent consequence. We're just trying to explain the reaction to why this may feel unfulfilling to certain people.
Yeah. At this point, we all know our way around the anatomy of a social media gaffe. It's a mob. And often the mob is not quiet until there's some sort of permanent impact on that person's job and position. Sometimes that is warranted. You know, most notably, there's criticism around the DA in the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia, because not only did she not indict the two men who murdered Ahmaud in broad daylight, she's pictured being friends with them, you know, so calling for appropriate discipline and consequences there feels appropriate and feels like what people want to demand where justice is concerned.
And there are degrees of that, right? Like we are on a spectrum right now, and at the most extreme end of that spectrum is the example you just cited. In a less extreme example of that spectrum, it's about community and the circles you run in. And so even though you and I are not advocating for anyone losing their job or specific consequences, what we're trying to illuminate and what critics of Alice and Roman continue to really pound is that there is a reality that Alice and Roman roles in a certain community, a certain circle of people, some of whom make decisions at the New York Times.
Yep.
They see her reflected back in themselves. And whatever private conversations were happening between Allison and these people before the incident, before the interview, during the interview, and now after the interview, there is a belief among certain people and a distrust among certain people who are critics of Alice and Roman that, first of all, they all think the same way.
Right.
Because how could this have gone this far? With the interview happening, the interview being published, the interview initially being praised by a certain sector and circle of media elite, as we had talked about, without being there being alarm bells raised. Right. And then only finally, once it got publicized and got to a wider audience where people were like, wait a second, this is some shit that's problematic. So in that circle, when we're talking about consequences, the reason why people may have some disappointment is because the people who would make a decision to hand down a consequence are more like Allison than they are different. So this is about, once again, coming back to diversity and inclusion and having a bigger bubble in which you can learn and grow and not be in a position to make a mistake like this because you have a perspective from somebody else who might think a little differently than you. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense, but I'm going to paraphrase it more casually because you were so articulate, but I want to...
Long-winded? Yeah.
No, but you're quite correct. But loosely speaking, I think your point being that people who are critical of this apology are feeling like, yeah, your bosses at the New York Times feel exactly the same way you do. They told you, just weather it down, make it go away. You're going to be fine. We all have your back. Instead of going, I can't believe you actually used language like that. And that applies to, as you point out, to the writer of the article in The New Consumer, who ran language that absolutely looked overtly racist without thinking there was something wrong with that or that it needed to be either noted or attributed or, you know, footnoted. Fair?
Yep.
Right.
So
I don't know if they're wrong.
I don't know if they're wrong, but I think that covers, I think, the not showing your work angle from Allison's perspective.
Yes. And as you say, we're not calling for anybody to lose their job because we're not. And because if we cancel somebody every time they make a mistake, nobody ever gets better, right?
Yes.
And then?
So, now on to Chrissy.
Now on to Chrissy.
Initially, when we talked about this, before Chrissy quit Twitter, before the dropping of the receipts on Chrissy's Twitter past,
yep.
We talked about, and this is the common thread throughout this entire episode, is asking ourselves, what does it cost you?
Yes.
And so we discussed whether or not Chrissy should have gotten involved in this conversation, should have chimed in, should have expressed her vulnerability and her hurt. And initially, you and I were both supportive of it.
Yeah. And for my part, I said that Chrissy Teigen was right in, you know, broadcasting that vulnerability because that's her whole brand, right? I feel great about this. I feel sad about that. I made a mess of this interview. I fell asleep in this work meeting. I did great in this situation. She's an open book. She always has been. That felt like her brand, right?
Right.
So to say I was hurt by Alison Roman, I always liked her, felt like the ongoing Twitter is my diary thing that Chrissy Teigen has had going.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as people pointed out, has had going for many, many years, which came back to bite her. When did your feelings change?
My feelings changed, actually, when, or started to change, and this was before I knew about the so-called receipts. My feelings changed when Milena sent me an email. Milena writes for our site and has written very nuanced and quite opinionated pieces on a variety of issues, a lot of them relating to race and race relations and racial perspectives. And she wrote to me and she was like, I understand that Chrissy Teigen is a woman of color, as am I, but for certain women of color, and I'm paraphrasing Milena, who was speaking on her own behalf, she was like, this also felt like victimhood.
Okay.
And so I thought to myself, okay, right away, I felt uncomfortable with that take, but I wanted to explore it further.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to sit on it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I completely agree with that particular take, but I do know that for those people who are reviewing Chrissy's receipts and reviewing the groups that Chrissy has targeted or made light of or hurt, it's hard for them to be like, oh, now you feel hurt? You're
right.
Good, right? What's the loss to you? You're safe. You're profitable. You have this many followers. And all of us are really just watching what we consider from our circles a heavyweight matchup that we would never be invited to. We don't write for the New York Times, and we don't have multiple cookbooks and a website and a reality show and a this and a that.
Right. And so, yeah, there is, I think that that works in, I think that only works in tandem with the receipts, by which, of course, we're talking about the tweets that are also, you know, offensive and punching down and so forth, right? It is in that context, it's the thing of everybody be cool until I get my feelings hurt, and then it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that again, I think then what would happen if Chrissy Teigen were here is she would say, yeah, but I never asked anybody to come out swinging for me. This only becomes a problem when Chrissy Teigen's bajillions of fans go after Alison Roman, right? Like, fangs out. I'm sure she was threatened and doxxed and all the rest of it. Then in turn, there are people from either Alison Roman's side or who are anti-Chrissy Teigen or whatever who then come at her. I think every person is entirely entitled to their feelings, to be hurt, to be vulnerable, to be annoyed, to be, as you said earlier, to feel kind of crotchety. I could do this. I could do that. The problem is doing it in a public forum. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. And I also think, in addition to that, what I don't like is the conflating of all the grievances. What happens is that when you criticize Alison Roman, who standalone legitimately didn't serve up a very good look for herself,
right?
You can't diminish that criticism but by saying, well, Chrissy used to be shitty too.
I mean, no, because that's the thing. It becomes a zero-sum game, right?
Yeah.
You and I have talked about whataboutism all the time. Here is a newsflash that I'm very, very comfortable putting right out there. Everybody has been shitty. Your favorite teacher, your favorite clergy person, your whomever if they were operating in a world where their every thought and joke and amusement, and I don't mean to write anything off as a joke because that's easy for everybody to do. If everything they said and did was broadcast online, they too would appear shitty. The correct argument back at me when I say that is, but they don't. But my clergy person or favorite teacher or my mom doesn't broadcast every unkind, uncharitable, vulnerable thought that they have, right?
Right.
So the issue is not that some people are or used to be shitty. Everybody is and has had shitty views, problematic views. My favorite thing is when people who I admire in all areas of equity say that they're still learning, when they point out areas where they themselves were wrong, when, you know, people use offensive terms without realizing it and are themselves corrected, even though they have also been educating others. It is a spectrum. It is a continuum. And you will die disappointed if you are looking for a perfect person in this life. Fair?
Agree.
But, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't a separate set of rules for people who live their lives in the public eye, because there is, especially because part of their business is courting the favor of people who follow them and watch them and read their news.
Right.
So to your point, then, you had a note that said, you know, this feels like so much victimhood, especially when combined with it's all fun and games when she's the one doing the mudslinging.
Right.
Then very likely in response to those tweets that were unearthed about problematic things Chrissy Teigen has said, because nobody is perfect. She said, I'm taking my ball and going home. I'm leaving mm-hmm. Twitter.
Yeah.
And of course, she could have just not tweeted, right?
That she was leaving Twitter. Yeah.
She could have just not tweeted overall. Like, you can just go silent for a while.
Yep.
I mean, you know, this is, we could spend hours on this, but the announcement of, hey, I'm leaving for a while is kind of performative in itself, right? And Chrissy Teigen is far from the first to have done it. And there are people who do it very, very regularly. And it's like, really, are you going to be that troubled by people going, hey, where are you? How are you? How have you been? If you just like peace out for a while without the announcement?
Yeah. And what happened was we recorded our first iteration of this on Sunday before that announcement came out. And I swear to you, all of you listening, Duane and I hit stop. We had a, okay, bye, have a good week, like, talk to you later, text me, you know, walked away from the recording equipment. 15 minutes later, I checked my phone and she had said, I'm out, peace out, I need to take a break from Twitter. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. Because it kind of negated what we had said previously about what her lane was and what her brand was. So to me, yeah, as you put it, Duanna, taking her ball or picking up her ball and going home is actually not of Chrissy Teigen's brand.
No. And now I'm going to use a term that somebody else has come up with. She flounced, right? It's not just leaving. It's when you toss your hair and say, I'm leaving because I don't like it here anymore. That is a performative flounce.
Correct.
And even then, I wouldn't like it, but I could maybe understand it, except that, of course, as you point out, some 24 hours later, she was back.
She was back after Allison issued her iOS apology. She responded to Allison's iOS apology by saying she appreciated Allison's apology and then referencing the mistakes that she's made in the past. See, and here's where I have a problem with Chrissy. There was an open door. Instead of taking your ball and going home, once those receipts started coming out, it would have been so much better if she did what Allison should have done in the first place, instead of making jokes or digging her heels in, being like, yeah, you guys found my old tweets and yep, I can't stand by them. And I am sorry. They suck. I cannot defend them. That said, it still doesn't make what Allison said about me right. Right?
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think, again, if Tegan were here, she might say, I can take anything you throw at me. It's when you, you know, lay abuse on my kids and say horrible things to and about them that I have the issue, which, you know, that's a can of worms we do not have time for. But people cannot hurl abuse at, say, Anne Hathaway's kid because we never see him and we don't know who he is, right? Like, it's that double-edged sword of, on the one hand, she uses her kids in her work all the time, but on the other hand, she doesn't want them to be subject to troll activity, etc. But, yeah.
I don't even mind that, Duanna. Like, I don't even mind that because if that were the case, it wouldn't have just been 24 hours. You know what I mean? Like, people are still coming for her kids, but she came back like so quickly and it was on the heels of a different apology. And it just, you know, if you, first of all, don't take your ball and go home. But if you are going to take your ball and go home, stay home for longer.
When we recorded a mere few days ago, I said that by rights, we should have been talking about a whole different flame war. And that's because last week, a fucking eternity ago on Twitter, people were calling out some really problematic, racially problematic, feministly problematic issues on America's Next Top Model. There are 1 bajillion cycles, so there's plenty of evidence. And so in a different context, we might have been talking about that instead, except that Tyra Banks, as she's very fond of saying, has been in this business a long time. And do you know what Tyra Banks did? She said, hey, I've been getting a lot of messages about problematic shit on America's Next Top Model. And you're right. Some of that stuff is seriously offside. And I'm sorry it's there. Anyway, hope you're well. Bye. Like,
I'm not laughing at the issue. I'm just laughing at your paraphrasing of what Tyra did. Because yes, it was in, it was out, and it was like, okay, but I love it. Yeah, okay, Tyra.
She did not defend herself and say, you know that I'm such a staunch supporter of the of women of color or of models or of whatever. She was just like, yeah, that was kind of shitty. Funny that. Whoops. Bye. She didn't say, I won't make the same mistake again. She didn't say, I hope you'll find it in your heart to forgive me. She got in, apologized for what people saw or acknowledged what people saw, which is what people really are looking for. And got back out. And that actually is the mark of a pro. Agreed?
Agreed.
I'm not trying to absolve Tyra Banks either, but man, like, that's how you shut it down. Because nobody is talking about her right now.
Or at least that's how you, like, refrain from making it bigger. How about that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Everything here that Allison and Chrissy did up to this point, Tuesday, 7:15 p.m. now, Eastern time, up until both of their acknowledgments of apologies and acknowledgments added fuel to a situation.
Yes, and that includes Chrissy Teigen's acceptance of Allison Roman's apology, which is public on Twitter. There's shit we don't know about. Maybe she had to do this publicly because people are coming for Allison Roman's mother. I don't know. But even in this tweet string, don't you feel like there's a little finger wagging? There's a little like, hi, Allison, thanks so much for your apology. You know, when I was in your shoes, I realized I couldn't just say whatever the fuck I wanted. The more we grow, this is a direct quote, the more we grow, the more we get those wake up calls. But how I still think some of those things, I just maybe don't unleash on my peers in super public platforms. Lol. I bring this up not to further litigate, but here I am. To your point, she's kind of still fanning the flames, right?
Yep.
Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong at all. And obviously, that's especially disappointing because we love Chrissy Teigen. And this is, but to your other point, nobody, least of all us, we are not perfect. And all of us have skeletons and all of us have said shitty things. And all of us have, like, if you wanted to pull the receipts, they're all there. It's about, okay, fine. What happens? And to go back to the thesis really of this episode, when you are faced with the decision of what to do when people have called you out on your fucking bullshit, and we all have our fucking bullshit, when you ask the question, what will this cost me? How do you make the right decision for what costs you the least? Because both people here made the decision that actually ended up costing them more.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because the only thing to do when you are called out, it's probably like a three-step process. And as soon as I explain it, I'll be like, oh, except for one more step. But first, whatever you're being accused of, you have to gut check. Really get real about, is this accurate? If somebody is throwing up one of your old tweets at you or something that you said somewhere and saying, this is bullshit and here's why, I have news. They are correct. It doesn't matter if you said it as a joke. It doesn't matter if it only works in context. They are correct. If somebody says you're an ugly pig, they are incorrect. Like, you know, you don't have to. No, but you don't have to take everything that some anonymous egg says as gospel. But if somebody is basically a human being and has some sort of well-reasoned point, then you kind of have to accept it. The next thing you have to do is not fucking deny. Like, I don't know where we all learned this or why we don't take in that kindergarten lesson of, like, stop lying. You're going to get caught. Don't say, no, I was never racist and I didn't mean that. It's about the name of a cookbook. Don't say, no, I didn't mean that about, I wasn't trying to be transphobic or whatever else. Like, just take it and then shut up for a while. My God. See, 3 points.
I think we've been pretty, I hope, like, we've covered it up to this point.
I mean, yeah, dude, it's pretty, we've spent a lot of mental real estate on these guys.
Yeah. I don't know if this is going to, like, kick off another longer conversation, but we can do the thing where we ask people to think about this and then come back to it. Because what came out of all of this mess, and I'm going to shout out our friend Lorella for it, is her final sort of, Lorella, I mean, her final sort of statement on this whole thing, because all of us were talking about this with our friends and sort of breaking it down. What I really love that Lorella had to say was about how, you know, Alison Roman's whole brand is about not having any fucks to give. And that's why people like her, because she's like, fuck the establishment and I don't want to be like this and blah, 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 blah. Or at least that is the image that she was conveying. And have people generally glorified the idea of not having any fucks to give? Because there is actually, if you think about it, privilege in who gets to not give a fuck. A lot of people give a lot of fucks. We care hard and we try hard. And then I go back to you many years ago defending Anne Hathaway against James Franco and trying too hard at the Oscars. And you always saying, I would rather someone try so hard than having someone not try at all.
Well, And look, you're right. We could go another hour here and we need to not do that. But Anne Hathaway and James Franco are the perfect example because he didn't give a fuck. He didn't try. And what we learn is he didn't suffer at all. He did just fine, even though that was an abysmal broadcast, because he has friends in high places. He has a support system. It's not going to land on him. And look, I learned this in grade 10, the first time I tried to mouth off to a teacher the way other kids were mouthing off to a teacher. Guess what? Those kids, their parents were teachers or otherwise in positions where it wasn't going to land on them. You actually don't get to not give a fuck unless you have a real elaborate support system around you in so many myriad ways. I bet Gwyneth Paltrow skipped a lot of school in high school. I bet a bunch of her classmates who were on scholarships didn't. They don't have that privilege, that opportunity. Being able to not give a fuck is absolutely based around knowing that, well, it actually won't blow back on me. And I agree with you. It's kind of like daring you to not give a fuck in many ways is the grown-up 2020 equivalent of somebody daring you to try cigarettes, right? Like, yeah. It's a real, like, show us how cool you are. And there's no sort of thought to, and let's not worry about whatever consequences roll down on you later on, because I'm not worried. So you don't have to be worried. But you have to be worried about you.
Put it this way. Michelle Obama never got to not give a fuck.
Not once.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Michelle Obama.
All right. Becoming was, I know you watched it really early. Did you dive into any of the watch party on the weekend, like the live Twitter watches, like group watches or on Instagram, anything like that?
I didn't. I watched the first day it came out, Wednesday. And I have watched it once more since. I think I watched it the next day. I didn't join any viewing parties, and I didn't want to. Like, I wanted Michelle to be for me. And sometimes I do want to do a viewing party for some of these things and be part of something. But I don't know. I think that obviously we all receive people and messages and art, I guess, as well, differently. And for me, it was very personal. This personal time with Michelle Obama.
Well, I agree with you. And I would say that the film is designed that way because as much as it's about her meeting all the people and inspiring the people and all these people she runs into, it's really the film more than the book is about how the solid, I'm stalling here trying to figure out how to conjugate this word. The film is about how solitary her life is. You know, one of the first earliest quotes is she says in the car, usually I just listen to my music, which is such a mom phrase, by the way, my music, as opposed to just music is so cute to me. But I felt like there were so many shots over and over of Michelle Obama being alone. Michelle Obama looking out the window of her childhood house. Michelle Obama in like an audio tent waiting to be called on stage. Michelle Obama, there's a great point where she's just sitting. She was probably listening or they were waiting for, noise to clear outside, but it looks as though she's just contemplating the enormity of her life. And so that's what was really interesting to me and kind of echoes your point, is that it was about her alone. So I understand why you wanted to watch it yourself alone.
What was your, what did you want to say though about the viewing parties?
Just that, I guess, that they focused on things that were wonderful. You know, her relating to students or moments with her children or Barack or whatever, but they weren't the ones that resonated with me as much. And I think that's probably the mark of a good film, and especially of a good documentary, that you don't know what's going to land with you, or that you take different things from it. And that's not considered to be not the point. That's kind of the gift of it.
Yeah. I will say though, that before I hit play, I read two reviews. I think that they were published ahead of the premiere, and they were both written by men, and they were both for major publications.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were like, it was a shrug. One was actually quite cynical about Michelle Obama and becoming like this having this huge Netflix deal or whatever. And the other was almost like, well, there's nothing new here. You know, you're not going to get to know her that much better. And I thought to myself, okay, well, I've read this. I will decide for myself. And after it was over, and this thing is a tight 89 minutes, I was like, well, of course they didn't get it. Of course they didn't get it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I think that, look, the book is massive and gangbusters. I don't know if men are reading it. I personally know a lot of men who have, but that's not speaking to its overall sort of sales records or who's reading. But I do think that the criticism of you're not going to get to know her any better here is interesting, because I actually think that's probably part of the thesis of the movie, that that's not actually what it's for.
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is what I mean. I don't think they got it.
Okay. So tell me what you got from it then. Having read the book, delighted in the book, we've talked a lot about how much we loved it and why. What did this doc give you?
I will tell you that I really, really appreciated the time spent in this tight 89 minutes devoted to the people in her life who are doing the work so that she can also do the work. I'm talking about
right,
Melissa Winter, Meredith Koop.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about Alan Taylor, her Secret Service agent, right?
Right.
I think that that is so important. I think that the reason why that felt so seamless is because while she's profiling the effort that other people are putting in so that she can make the effort, she's also taking the time to profile the young students and young women that she's meeting, or she was meeting on the tour. So it wasn't just moments where they had their moment with Michelle. That was our introduction. That was our introduction to these young women. But then afterwards, we follow up with what they're doing when they're graduating from high school, when they're at home with their families, getting ready for school. So what she's doing isn't necessarily, here's who I am. What she was doing is, I think you know who I am, so let me use me to introduce you to them. And I think that that is part of the thesis of the documentary.
Well, that's really, really interesting. And, you know, to jump around a bit, I think anybody with a casual interest in Michelle Obama or in this doc knows that the one sort of alleged no-go zone was her children, right?
Yeah.
That their participation and their comments and so forth. And I think that's really interesting because of opening that door to these young people who we don't know, who we might know in the future, it was allowed that Malia and Sasha could also be like also Rands almost in this doc. They are two other young women that we meet, but they get exactly the same amount of airtime, if not less, right? A sentence or two. This is our take on the world, but not this is our superstar studded, oh my God, my parents are so glamorous take on the world. We are recording this on Mother's Day, and you can see that what they said could be any college student's opinion of their new empty nest mom, like finding her own life, right?
Yep.
That's what I thought was really interesting. I also think the more I think about your the critics that you read before you watched it, I also wonder if when you say they didn't get it, it's about what their expectation was for a documentary like this, right? Michelle Obama is this weird creature that we have created who is essentially ascending to a throne that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. She's our collective favorite person. She's everybody wants to know what she's doing. She's kind of with it, but she's also protecting her own interests and so forth. She is, you know, it's that Oprah mold, right? But she refuses to sort of be shot in that sparkly, glowy light. Everything is so normal in this documentary. She talks about, you know, things they ate a lot of McDonald's. And she talks about kisses she had with people who weren't Barack Obama. And she talks about, I can't remember if she said here that she, there's that picture of her circa college age when she's talking about not fitting into Princeton, where she looks kind of really sulky and annoyed. She's resolutely normal throughout. You know, and she kind of refuses to be ascended to that place. This is not a coronation in this film, right?
No.
And I think a lot of people who think of her as an incredibly powerful, persuasive speaker want to see her with that arms raised pose of like, we will continue to ignite hope. And this whole doc is about, I kind of refuse to be who you want me to be, even if that want me to be is a really good person, a really good place. I am taking my time being normal. That was my overwhelming feeling, was the normalcy.
And I think that we addressed this when we talked about the book, that part of the objective, especially when she wrote about Barack Obama, was
Is that where you're going?
Mythologizing and unmythologizing.
I feel like you just have to pick a syllable and go with it.
So it was an unmythologizing. And I think that that is so true of what you're saying in terms of how the documentary is a companion. They've always said that the documentary, this film, is a companion to the book. So it has to be, like, obviously, it has to have the same tone. If the book is about, hey, we were these people, we worked really hard, and I know my husband is a genius, but he also is a dick who went to the gym, like told me he was coming for home for dinner and then detoured to the gym for 2 hours.
Right.
And was late all the time.
Right. And you're right. That comes up again here that, you know, they went to counseling and she thought it was to fix him. And then she found out, oh shit, I have work to do as well.
Yeah.
You know, that she's just a regular person when she talks to people. She's not anointing each of them with a kiss and a glow and they go off with their new sort of fairy godmother given powers. To me, there's one part of the doc that so clearly cements this. And I don't know if you felt this way, but to me, it was easily the best part of the whole thing and kind of underscores that thesis. What did you have a favorite part?
I don't know that I had a favorite part. I think that like every 3 minutes I was just like, nodding my head, taking notes. So it's obviously the whole thing.
Because I think to me, my favorite part, and I should have known that it would be coming, but I loved it so much, was the sequence where they introduce her brother, Craig. And she talks about how her mother goes nuts over her brother, Craig. And they go to Craig's house and she's like, all I hear about is Craig's wine. How great is Craig's wine? And everybody in the Robinson family is talking about how Michelle kind of comes second to Craig as a, you know, as the second child and as the sort of less overtly leadership person. But I felt like that was a bit thumbing her nose at people too, going like, I'm not going to be your leader. I'm not going to be your Oprah. I am not that important to people sometimes. And that's kind of the joy of me, is that my family still sees me as not as exciting as Craig. When's Craig coming for Thanksgiving at the White House? And it's sort of very, it's a very untypical way of showing, hey, I'm normal, but it felt so authentic as a result that it's, I could really believe, even though people say it all the time, that to her family, to her brother and her mother, she is exactly the same person, and none of her successes or the way that she addresses, you know, stadiums full of people across North America is going to impact the way they think about her.
But you know what? That goes back to the expectation of who doesn't get it and who gets it. Because for those people who were like, I expected more revelation or more vulnerability, I think they were going in thinking that this is going to be the next leader, that this woman has ambitions for something beyond what she already was, or they don't believe the, I don't know, dozens of times that she has been clear when she has said, I am not running for office. This is not what I want. They somehow, for some reason, don't actually believe it. And this film isn't like an announcement of a campaign. It isn't like a snapshot of someone who has ambition for more, or at least more in the political realm. There is nothing in the film to suggest, beyond the fact that she's simply just so likable, there's really nothing in the film to suggest that she is going to run. In fact, quite the opposite. As you said, Duana, there is nothing special about me. I am not the savior. I will not be the savior. I refuse to be categorized and characterized as the savior. And so I wonder if that was the, I don't know, the letdown that some people, certain men or two writers that I'm talking about, when they went in and thought that this, there are no revelations here, that you won't learn anything new. There's a lot new that can be picked up in this documentary that is a companion to the book. It's just what they, it's just not what they were looking for.
Well, yeah. And I think that part of that, what you're looking for, what they're looking for, comes from somebody who has the ability, right? People who want Michelle Obama to run for office, any kind of office, see that she has what it takes, right? She has the personality, she has the smarts, she has the real connection with people. It's understandable that people would hope for that. But what I love about this film is that, in fact, it is sort of her saying, actually, fuck you. I'm done being defined by anybody else's expectations. Actually, I'm going to decide exactly how much I want to be in the public image. And I'm not joking about that. And I can't be persuaded otherwise. And that's what is super exciting. And that's what is one of the things that's different about the book, right? The book is what happened before. And this is very much a prologue to what's happening next. And it's very clear that, you know, we always hear this as women, right? Women keep saying, as you get older, you stop giving a shit what other people think and you start living only for yourself. And it's very clear that she's like, I did my time. I like catered to other people's expectations. I am now finished. Here's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to do me, literally. And I can see how that seems like a bit of a fuck you factor to people, but I'm so, so here for it.
But it's also an alternative perspective about power. As you said, she's good at all the things. And so naturally, the way that we, or at least in a society that has been shaped by male desire and male ambition, when you're good at all the things, you naturally seek the position, the most powerful position, like in which to flaunt all that power or all that capability or use it. And what she's saying, or what she's modeling for us, is that You can be capable in all the things, but you don't have to desire that model of power that has previously been set out for us, men and women, because, of course, as we know, the male trajectory usually is the one that has been laid out as the quickest way to the top or the only way to the top. So it's really interesting. I think it's a really interesting meditation on where you take your abilities and what power means to you.
I really, really like that, especially because, she and Barack Obama are incredibly influential politically still. And I think there's almost we are slightly sheltered from American politics and also not sheltered at all. But I think there's a slight expectation in the fractious Democratic Party that if you can help the mess we're in, you should help. If you can help, spoon America away from what it is currently mired in, then you have an obligation to do so. And what I love about what you're saying about power is that I'm sure she has intent about helping, but it's going to be on her terms and not on anybody else's or in the way they think it should look. And, she doesn't owe the political factions who used her when they needed her anything other than what she chooses to give and what she feels sort of personally obligated to contribute.
But that's also why she's sharing it. Like, this is a documentary, as we already talked about the people who staff her, the people whose work enables her work. And that's both in front of the camera in this documentary in, Melissa, Meredith, Allen, and also the young women, the students, but also behind the scenes, the woman who directed this film, Nadia Hallgren, this is her first feature film, has never directed a film before. Friend of a friend situation, recommended, and then went for a meeting with Michelle Obama. After that one meeting, at the meeting, Michelle Obama offered her the job. Now, this is Michelle Obama, right? You've written a book at this point. You're about to go on the book tour. And you don't, as Nadia Hallgren tells The Hollywood Reporter, she, at the time, Michelle Obama was like, I'm not sure what this is going to turn into. We're capturing footage here. It could just be my own personal footage. We could turn it into something. I don't know. But, do what you can. And what you can now has been turned into a Netflix documentary airing during a pandemic with lots and lots and lots of people watching. And now the profile of this young female director, also a woman of color, has been raised to the point where she can go on storytelling. And so I think that is what I think a lot of people who don't get it miss in what Michelle Obama is revealing about herself in this documentary.
And that it's continually, extending arms all the ways and extending all the things, right?
Making more space.
Making more space. But to me, it's a lesson in what things look like on the outside versus what they turn out to be. So at the end of the film, the credit comes up, directed by Nadia Hallgren. The next credit that comes off is cinematographer, Nadia Hallgren. So that means she's holding her own camera. She's setting up or finding, in the case of a doc follow like this, her own shots. You might feel, as somebody covering Mrs. Obama's book tour, like, shouldn't I have a camera operator? Shouldn't I have somebody to do this so that I can just be watching and finding the shots and the whatever? Maybe she didn't. Maybe she was like, no, I don't want that extra person. And certainly it's not a question of finances. They could afford to have that extra person there. What I love is that by being both things, by being the person who is finding all the shots and seeing all the moments, that's why Nadia is able to make a film that has moments and connections like this. This is why it's not just a set of shots for the archives. It's because she was able to be both hats at both times. And I love that something that can seem on the surface like it's a problem can actually turn out to be a gift, right? Something like, oh, I'm both operating and also kind of watching and covering and so forth, is what gave her the ability to be the director as well as the cinematographer. You know, that was kind of the job she was interviewed for. And being there the whole time is what gave her the ability to kind of be the director of the film after the fact.
But also being an up-and-comer, as you said, there may be a downside to it, but the big, big, big upside in this situation is that nobody knew who she was. So this was really, really kept locked down until a week before the documentary came out. We hadn't heard of it. There was no announcement. There was no leak. But 1 week before Netflix dropped the documentary, that was when the statement came out. That was when the trailer came out. And then we were like, oh, fuck, next week we're all watching the Michelle Obama documentary. As Nadia tells The Hollywood Reporter, it was obviously the most top secret thing ever. They all agreed not to talk about it. But she was able to kind of just also be discreet in her shooting. But how fucking discreet can you be when you're holding a camera around Michelle Obama, right? It's really like, I love all of that. I love how that all of it is executed.
Right. But she's a young woman. The cameras don't have to be huge anymore. Probably she was hiding in plain sight. Probably she looked like somebody who was a part of the entourage, who was also consulting with Melissa and or everybody else on the team. You know, for all they knew, she was a senior or a post grad doing an internship. Nobody knew, and including, as we point out, Michelle Obama herself, nobody knew then that this was going to be the biggest drop on Netflix in the first week of May. It was just sort of like, let's just follow around and see what we see, meaning that it was Nadia Hallgren who made her own opportunity, who was like, look what I can give you out of the unobtrusiveness that I did.
Yeah, it's I love this interview because it is like the becoming of becoming.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
How becoming became. And it's obviously really exciting that, you know, a young filmmaker, my God, like when your first documentary is about Michelle Obama, like I'm also a little bit scared for Nadia Hallgren because I don't know where you go from there. However, obviously I have full confidence. Mrs. Obama has full confidence in Nadia. But, you know, when I was reading this article, this Q&A with Nadia Hallgren, the thing that kept coming to mind for me is a phrase that you made popular that you heard from somebody else. And it doesn't cost you anything. And
right.
I think in the case of work and for Michelle Obama, what would it cost her to offer the job to a complete amateur and a novice? Really? You're already Michelle Obama. Nothing.
It costs nothing. She did some press, not a ton, but she did some press in any given city around the tour. There were those photos released. There were clips released on the news. It was being covered from that angle. If this turned out to be a bunch of wonky shots that didn't do anything, oh well. It
yep.
doesn't cost anything. In the literal sense, it costs nothing to employ that person and to whatever her salary was and whatever the budget for, you know, tape stock and editing was. It wasn't that much. And it's no real effort until it was clear that there was something here, mm-hmm. right? The sit down with Michelle Obama is done much later, way later. We don't know how far, but the moments with, you know, when she goes back to her old home on the south side of Chicago, that kind of thing. She's not hosting the film. She's not like giving it a ton of energy. In fact, that trip back to her house, her parents' house, is probably the most focused on the doc film on the camera that she is, right?
Yeah.
So you're exactly right. It's like, let's give room for opportunity to happen, for lack of something less twee to say, you know, and see how it goes.
I always love that phrase, you know, it doesn't cost me anything or it doesn't cost anything, because I don't know that in our work lives, we really take stock of it, how many times you can help or you can do a thing or you can own a thing, like take ownership of either a mistake or, yeah. or share credit for a win or not have credit for a certain thing. I mean, it depends. Obviously, everything is relative to what the situation is. But the question to ask is, what will it cost? Really take stock of what it will cost.
Yeah. And I think that people don't often use that kind of language, again, around women, right? It's about, oh, and we toddle up to the line, but then we don't, right? It's about the second shift or emotional labor or whatever, but we don't sort of look at it from an economic point of view and say, well, can you afford this? Can you afford to help this person? What do you have in the bank? Did you just have a huge win? Okay, so you have some stuff in the bank, sort of energy-wise, wisdom-wise. Michelle Obama has taken the time. She also didn't do any of this in 2016. You know, she took the time until she was able to be generous. She didn't overpromise what this film would be. There aren't big confessionals, right? There aren't like searching moments where they walk through the Obama's new home and she's like, well, this is how it is now. Now that we're empty nesters, Barack still goes to the gym. There's nothing. She didn't overpromise emotionally, but she had the room and the wherewithal to give this opportunity to Nadia and to go, if it turns out to be nothing or something, then we're set. Then we're good either way. I guess that also means having no expectations though, right?
Yeah.
That's hard. Yes? Or is it not?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to put myself in someone like Michelle Obama's shoes. I think that either her expectations are completely on a different plane than mine, and probably they're much more lofty, like an unimaginable expectation. I think that if there was one place where she got real raw and vulnerable about expectation and its sister, which is disappointment or brother. It's near the end. And this is, again, what I think critics would have missed. It's near the end and that moment when she talks about the 2016 election and she talked about what she and Barack Obama and their family being the first Black family in the White House meant to people and how that work wasn't, and I'm paraphrasing what she said, but it really wasn't honored by the Black community in the sense that they didn't come out to vote. And it's the sharpest language that she uses that is also laced with a lot of sadness. And there was true grieving there in that moment, I think, because she was really confronting the fact that Black Americans or the Black community didn't come out and vote in the way that they had hoped.
In the numbers that they had hoped.
That's right. Sorry, yes, in the numbers that they had hoped. And that was a real, like, you could see a real pain there. And if there's any, like, the most vulnerable moment in the film is right there. So when we go back and talk about expectation, you can get to expectation by talking about your disappointment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. But again, I think that moment in particular was just coverage that Nadia would have been doing while Michelle was talking to a group of people. You know, it's an open and honest moment that she had being real with real people, as opposed to kind of a preachy lecture, which it's been quoted a lot of places. But in that context of this is what I'm going through, though the clip doesn't continue, you're exactly right. The understanding is that the next breath in that conversation is, here's how I dealt with that disappointment. Here's how I managed my expectations. Here's what I know now about what you hope for versus what you receive. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that it goes down so easily, even though none of us want to disappoint her because she's everybody's mom, is because she's not saying it to camera in an interview in a lecture scenario.
Yeah.
It's just it's a diary entry. It's a confession of feelings. And so it felt very, very vulnerable and palatable as a result.
And yet, remember, like, this documentary was produced by Higher Ground, which is the Obama's production company. So listen, everything that we see in the documentary is clearly vetted and cleared through Michelle Obama herself. So in that editing process, you know, I would imagine that obviously Nadia would have come with a first cut and then a second cut or whatever. But the fact that that stayed, that Nadia cut that in there and Mrs. Obama signed off on it, it tells you enough about what she wants out there and what she's willing to let you see, the rawness that she's willing to let you see.
Well, I think more than anybody, maybe not more than anybody, but she has talked more than almost anyone in the media, short of, recording artists, about the strictures of being in the public eye, about how oppressive it is, about how everything she ever said was misinterpreted. That also, of course, is because the press went for her every misstep and misspeak much more like acutely than many, many other people, right? But yeah, you're right. She is reacting to her freedom now and feeling the freedom of, do you know all the things I couldn't say? Here's but a few.
Exactly. And so, yeah, to go back to what you take from it and whether or not you get it, I mean, I think it says, as always, more about the person who's not getting it than the person you're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, in terms of their expectations, mm-hmm. in terms of what they hoped it would be.
There you go.
Absolutely, I think that's the case. But I think, too, it was a real, almost, people always pronounce this word weirdly, a primer for the kinds
of... Who says primer?
Ira Glass on This American Life says primer a lot, and I feel like it's influenced a lot of people.
Okay, that is so... Okay, great.
Anyhow... This is like, it's like the exercise in the textbook that they do for you, right? This is a good indication of what Higher Ground productions may give to us. Mm-hmm. There'll be a little bit of what we like. They have incredibly influential stars that may appear the same way Barack Obama appears in The Last Dance. Like, there might be a little of that, but it's not going to be feel good hugs all the time. You're not going to come out of each one with a, like feeling like it's a sunshine sandwich. It's going to give you exactly what they want to give you and no more. And I believe that whether it's about global warming or, educating children in underschooled areas or whatever it is, that it's not going to be too gentle on you. That's the expectation, I think, or the model that they're setting up. And I'm really, really here for that. That's it for this week. As always, thank you so much for sending us your thoughts. We love hearing from you and your thoughts on what everybody's doing when they're supposed to be social distancing.
And thank you so much for subscribing to us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, leaving comments and reviews. We appreciate the support. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.